The next case on our oral argument calendar today is case number A18-708, Bursaw versus Bursaw. The court appreciates counsel being present and timely today under adverse conditions. Counsel for appellant, is it Mr. Friedrichs?
Yes.
You may approach and begin. As you know, you have 15 minutes for your initial argument and an opportunity for 5 minutes of rebuttal after that.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, as you've noted, I'm Carl Friedrichs, and I hear on behalf of Richard Bursaw. The facts are set forth in our briefs and the numerous exhibits submitted in this matter. I'm here asking the court to review the order granted and consider the fundamental fairness of this matter. From the beginning of this case, Mr. Bursaw was at a substantial disadvantage. It's like tying a fighter's arms to his side and putting a weight on his ankle and saying, go in the ring and try to deal with this situation. They had, based on the attorney's records submitted in this matter, they had prepared a petition for dissolution in 2014, even before Mr. Bursaw was incarcerated, but they waited to serve this until he was incarcerated, when he had no ability to access documents and other information in the matter. The first issue I'd like to address is the $20,000 sanction awarded to the respondent. It's not supported by either the facts or the law. It primarily appears to be based on the alleged garage break-in that occurred in 2014, basically 2 years before the petition for dissolution was even served.
But the findings of fact would refer to other items, the lack of discovery and lack of forthrightness in the his responses.
Mr. Bursaw, Mr. Saucier, in taking the case, understood Mr. Bursaw was in jail and he was doing the best he could, getting contact with Mr. Bursaw and providing information, having to order documents and get releases and produce information.
That's not the way the court saw it, though.
That's not the way the court saw it. And if you read findings of fact 60 to 62, 82, and 83, in my opinion, there's a lot of focus on the court on this garage break-in incident. In fact, when it gets to the findings or the decision in March of 2018, the court in its 2018 memorandum again states the garage break-in issue and the GPS issue as a reason that helps justify the sanction in this matter.
But, and just to follow, I mean, I had the same thought as Judge Smith. On page 24 of the order, paragraph 84, the district court recites, I think, four different issues that motivated the fee award, right?
That were there as additional means of motivating the fee award. But the garage issue, I think, is rather important and relevant. And it's completely a baseless claim. Peter Bursaw admits it's speculation. The respondent was not allowed to testify as to who she thought it was because of speculation. And Courtney Walker never said who it was. And the court used that to affect the credibility decisions and to affect this sanction decision. Mr. Saucier did the best he could with the information that Mr. Bursaw had, which was nothing while he's incarcerated. They gathered information, they released information, it took time to do it, but it does not, just the discovery issues certainly do not justify a $20,000 sanction in this matter. That is way overextensive in my opinion. The other thing is the due process and the fair trial issue. An incarcerated person is entitled to a meaningful hearing in a meaningful time and matter. The court did grant Mr. Saucier an additional 2 months to prepare for the trial when he asked for that in April of 2017, and that's when his ability to gather information was ramped up and information was disclosed. However, the prison system would not allow Mr. Bursaw any more than 1 hour by telephone testimony to participate in this action. They were not going to allow him to be released to come down to Mankato for the trial. Mr. Saucier, if that was an available option, certainly would have arranged to have Mr. Bursaw down there.
Did
excuse me.
Go ahead. There are other alternative means of appearing in court, such as ITV. Was that explored?
My understanding is that Mr. Saucier got a hold of the prison system, folks, because he was there and had visited Mr. Bursaw, and they said he gets 1 hour on this day.
But my question, was that explored?
I suspect it was, but I'm not Mr. Saucier. I wasn't present in the discussions with them.
Is there something in the record that would show that that was explored?
There's nothing in the record showing it was explored. There is in the record where Mr. Saucier asked for more time and an accommodation, page 206 of the transcript and page 340 of the transcript. Especially after this garage break-in incident comes up, Mr. Saucier explains this wasn't explained to me, that the witnesses may talk about this, Your Honor. I'd like to have an extension or an accommodation. That was not granted.
Was there some motion that was made that specifically asked for certain accommodations or?
Other than that verbal request, I did not see anything else in the transcript. There was a request and a motion brought in August of 2017 after submission of the proposed findings, requesting that the case be reopened to allow that information regarding the ankle bracelet and the GPS monitoring and some testimony at that time, but the court refused that opportunity at that time.
It seemed that the trial court was somewhat sympathetic to Mr. Saucier because the court had represented clients in, who were incarcerated in the past, as I recall. Is that not accurate?
The court was, I wasn't there. I don't know how the court reacted on those requests other than they were not granted. And even when the 1 hour of telephone time arrived, the court instructed Mr. Saucier, you're going to get approximately 25 minutes. That's at page 187 of the transcript. Well, Mr. Saucier knew he had a lot of tracing information he had to go through. He was all of a sudden aware of a garage threat break-in. To try to get this all done in 25 minutes, he had to focus on quick shots and issues. The respondent brings up in their brief that Mr. Bursaw's answer when he was asked, did you ever break into your garage, was no. Well, all right, no is the answer, I didn't do it. Is Mr. Saucier supposed to spend more of his precious 25-minute time addressing that issue or get on to other information that he's got to get into the record to try to show the non-marital claim and explain the reasons for the actions regarding all the real estate? Mr. Saucier appears from the transcript to have chosen to move on to the next item because a clear no answer was given.
the appellant's attorney indicated that he thought 1 hour would be enough, did he not, at one point?
That was at the very beginning of the trial, before he was aware of the allegations that would come up regarding the someone entering into the garage and the other comments that were made from the witnesses that had not been disclosed to Mr. Saucier beforehand. Our position is that the 1 hour of time without an additional hearing date did not give Mr. Bursaw sufficient time to explain, especially when that hour, 1 hour of time was essentially limited to 25 minutes. Now we get to the non-marital claims and the tracing. And in this case, we are arguing that the court applied an improper standard in looking at this. The court didn't consider all of the exhibits that Mr. Saucier and Mr. Bursaw put in showing each individual transaction. There were over 22 exhibits showing a purchase price, a sale price, and a mortgage that had to be paid off to accomplish the sale. The initial testimony was, and still is, that Mr. Bursaw was the sole owner of the initial house and sold that. And then Mr. Bursaw's presentation, based on the documents is the equity moved up to the next house all the way along. The case law cited in the briefs shows that that should be sufficient to establish by a preponderance of the evidence the ability to trace, and Mr. Saucier in his submissions showed how the equity traced through from year to year. How the court expected Mr. Bursaw to come up with closing statements from 20 years ago or any, given the fact that he was incarcerated and there was no access to the house to even go through boxes of information that may have been there by Mr. Bursaw, is beyond me. They did the best they could. They presented a preponderance of the evidence that there was equity in each house and showed that. The court did not then require the respondent to prove by clear and convincing evidence something other than non-marital equity transferring up. During her testimony, she never denies that there was equity from the initial houses and funds provided by Mr. Bursaw that continued to go into the future houses. She never denies that 140 Mary Oak Lane was built on real estate that Mr. Bursaw received from his father's trust when his father passed away. They don't deny that, much less rise to the level of clear and convincing evidence offsetting the movement of equity from one property to the other.
Let me ask this, because I'm not sure what standard of review you're asking us to make here. Is it an abuse of discretion or error of law?
We're asking for a review de novo based on the error of law because the court did not go number one step, preponderance of the evidence of tracing, number two step, showing she did not provide clear and convincing evidence otherwise.
Okay, so you're saying it's an error of law that...
The way the court applied its decision-making process. And for the respondent to argue that the court was able to determine the credibility of Mr. Bursaw based on some affidavits that were set, in essence getting documents into the record and an hour worth of testimony is just amazing to me. When Mr. Saucier said, I'd like more time, he only had 25 times with his client. The credibility decisions, especially the ones where the court says, I find him incredible because of the comments made in the affidavits. The documents attached to the affidavits are accurate. They show the dollar numbers that were there. And the documents are what shows the tracing, and that's the tracing information that gets to the preponderance level. Our argument again is the court had to then look to the clear and convincing, the next step of the law in the cases, and require the respondent to show something other than a non-marital interest on those equity moves. She never claims that. The other argument relates to the joint tenancy on the real estate that was transferred from the trust. As the testimony at trial was, it was for estate planning purposes. There was no donative intent. It was to simplify things to avoid probate. Mr. Bursaw did not completely give away his interest in the real estate. When he intended to make a gift, he did that later when he gave the land to his son Peter that his father had wanted to go over to his son Peter. In fact, the respondent agreed with that, and that transfer was made with respondent's signature on those documents. That was a completed and full gift. Again, the court didn't apply the appropriate standard, in our opinion, for reviewing that. So our request for relief is that the court reverse the decision on the sanction completely, because it is for primarily, in my opinion, and looking at the information based on this alleged garage incident and insufficiently and inappropriately on the documents that Mr. Bursaw was able to disclose given his position in being incarcerated. So we would ask that the court immediately reverse the sanction matter and then remand for new trial or at least an additional hearing on the other tracing issues and other issues that remain out there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Friedrichs. Counsel for respondent.
Thank you. Good morning. I'm Julia Ketchum Corbett of Blethyn Barrons in Mankato, and along with my associate, Alyssa Thiebert Nelson, represent the respondent in this case, Beth Ann Widorf, formerly Beth Bursaw. Ms. Widorf is in the courtroom today as well. The trial court in this case should be affirmed on all four issues raised by the appellant. The appellant clearly received a fair hearing at a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner as required by the due process considerations of our Constitution. The trial court also did not err in determining that the appellant failed to meet his burden by a preponderance of the evidence to establish his non-marital claim by credible testimony or through documentary evidence. The trial court also appropriately found that the land transferred to both parties during the marriage by the Gerald Bursaw Trust was marital. And finally, the trial court did not abuse discretion in its award of attorney's fees. I'll follow.
Can I ask you about the, I'm sorry, the, yeah. The transfer of that property, was is that independent of the tracing issues, or does that sort of subsume the tracing issues? In other words, if we were to uphold the district court's ruling on that particular point, do the other tracing issues, are they still relevant?
I think there's two tracing issues. So there's tracing issues in the equity in the homestead, mm-hmm. and then there's potentially tracing issues in the land underneath the homestead. The land underneath the homestead is the property, part of the property that was transferred by the Gerald Bursaw Trust. With regards to that gift, I think there's essentially kind of a two-part analysis, and I think the trial court dealt with both parts. First, because it was acquired by the parties during the marriage, it is presumed to be a marital asset.
And what's it now? Could you be, you said it.
I apologize.
That's okay. Yeah.
The gifted land. Okay. I'm trying to address your gift question, mm-hmm. Your Honor. So that gifted land was gifted to the parties during the marriage, and as such, under Minnesota Statute 518.003, it is presumed to be marital property. So then, under the case law, the burden transfers to the appellant, if he is making a non-marital claim, to trace that non-marital claim or to prove that non-marital claim, to prove that it came to him by gift to him alone or by inheritance or was acquired by some other non-marital means. If he can't do that, then it's marital and there's no further tracing necessary. The trial court looked at that transfer and essentially said, this was a transfer to the two parties. It was never owned by the appellant individually. It was owned by the Gerald Bursaw Trust. When Gerald Bursaw passed away, the trust transferred the property to the appellant and the respondent. And so there was no inheritance individually to the appellant. There was no gift individually to the appellant. The trial court went the next step, however, because if for some reason there's a determination that it was a non-marital inheritance or gift, then the burden shifts to the party trying to establish that it's marital, a marital asset. So the burden shifts to the respondent in this case, who's claiming it's a marital asset, to prove that it was transmuted into marital property by a gift. And the trial court looks at those three elements: donative intent, delivery, and absolute disposition. And intent is the most important of those three. And frankly, it's the issue that appellants seem to be most focused on. And intent is a finding of fact. Intent where there is conflicting evidence is a determination of credibility, and both of those items, the finding of fact and the credibility, are in the province of the fact finder, are in the province of the district court.
What about the argument that this was a estate planning device to put it in both names?
The court heard evidence on both of those issues and determined that that evidence was not credible, and based on the totality of the circumstances, in looking at other case law and basing it on the totality of the circumstances, looked at the fact that at the time the transfer occurred, the parties had been married, I believe, 8 years. They continued to be married 12 years after that. They were in a happy marriage that the appellant understood through his counsel that the property, by transferring it into joint tenancy, if appellant died, would become the respondent's and had been transferred to her. The court also looked at the fact that they had built a homestead on this property together after the property was transferred, that they made major improvements with marital funds. And so there were quite a lot of other factors beyond the question of just estate planning that the court looked at. And ultimately, it resolved that in favor of the fact that the wife had proven by clear and convincing evidence that if it was non-marital property at some point, it had been transmuted into marital property through that transfer.
You agree that the standard of review is de novo?
On the gift issue, yes. On the tracing issue, no.
Ms. Corbett, if I could turn to the attorney's fees award.
Yes.
When I think of conduct-based attorney's fees in dissolution cases, I typically think of conduct that occurred after the dissolution was filed or something usually in the course of the litigation. Can you point us to any cases where an award has been upheld based upon something that happened, 2 years before the dissolution was even filed?
I can't specifically point the court to case law on that issue, but I don't think that's the point on which the trial court decided the issue. The trial court decided the issue based on the four factors. I believe Judge Smith commented earlier, perhaps it was Judge Johnson. The trial court listed four factors, and while the garage break-in itself happened before the dissolution, the testimony about the assets and whether they existed and were they dissipated, were they hidden, happened during the process. And so while the break-in itself happened prior to the dissolution process, there's no question about that. The sanction is based on the complete failure to conduct and respond to discovery. The court has in its record the request for production of documents. I believe there were 20-plus requests. We received one piece of paper, a credit card statement. The answers to interrogatories are completely devoid of responses. And so that creates additional cost to the respondent in having to get those documents. So there were other bases, I think, during the matter.
I understand that there were other bases, at least according to the district court, for the award, but shouldn't we then, I'm looking at finding 82, husband's conduct in intruding into the house and removing property. I mean, that's not about whether or not you're disclosing assets. I mean, shouldn't we then be saying, look, that was a factor that was perhaps that was inappropriate, and remand, say, you know, decide any attorney's fees on appropriate factors?
I think given that the other factors form an appropriate basis for the attorney's fees, the fact that that factor, that statement occurred before the hearing doesn't require a remand for the court to likely simply remove that factor and say, here are the other factors, and they are still an appropriate basis for a sanction. And the court also, in addition to Minnesota Statute 518.14, the court has inherent discretion to sanction, and that is not necessarily based upon actions during a process. Under the Ford Crown Victoria case, which is cited in our brief, the court stated that in addition to statutory authority to impose sanctions, district courts possess inherent authority to impose sanctions as necessary to protect their vital function, the disposition of individual cases to deliver remedies for wrongs and justice freely. So perhaps that goes to your first question about case law in terms of behaviors outside of the process. The court has that inherent authority to deliver justice. And in this particular case, the court looked at all of that, and I don't believe it abused its discretion in making that sanction. In terms of the due process argument, due process in our state and country requires a fair hearing and a meaningful time and in a meaningful manner. To go back to Judge Smith's question about ICTV, I don't believe that was explored. I was involved in the case from the very start, and to my knowledge, that was never explored. What also appears to not have been explored is Minnesota Statute 589.35. which allows counsel for the appellant to request that the penal institution release the prisoner to the district court. A motion could have been made under that statute to the district court to request that the penal institution be required to release Mr. Bursaw for the purposes of trial. That was never done.
Well, could you repeat that statute, please?
Yes, 589.35. Under that statute, the district court has the ability to order the penal institution to release the prisoner to district court. The court has to determine how to deal with the costs of that. So there would be transfer costs and costs to put him up likely in the Blue Earth County Jail during a 2-day trial. But the bottom line is that wasn't even requested. And that's within the appellant's ability. He had counsel, and that wasn't done. I think it's important to remember that in a civil case, Mr. Bursaw, the appellant here, had no right to be in attendance at the hearing. He had no right to testify at this hearing. He had no right to testify by affidavit or by phone or in any other means. The trial court, as the court has pointed out, stated on numerous occasions that the trial court was somewhat sympathetic with the fact that there were some challenges to representing someone who's in prison, but that those challenges can be overcome and need to be dealt with, and that Mr. Saucier accepted the representation knowing the situation of his client. The trial court, with the respondent's agreement, allowed numerous affidavits into testimony. There was no limit put on the number of affidavits, and the appellant traced his non-marital claim through his testimony in three separate affidavits. The trial court also did not limit the testimony by phone. At the start of the hearing, Mr. Saucier indicated he thought he was going to have 3 hours. He had found out that morning he was only going to have 1 hour, and so, but that 1 hour would be sufficient. I think also if the court looks at the record, what the court will see is that in that testimony, direct examination happened. I got some time for cross-examination, and then Mr. Saucier got time for redirect examination, and he finished that. He stopped and said to the court, if I continued, I would just be beating a dead horse. So he stopped his questioning. I got cut off in my cross-examination of the respondent.
If I can, yes. If I may, counsel, going back to your point about Minnesota Statute 589.35, yes. Wouldn't it be reasonable, though, if counsel, Mr. Saucier, if he thought he had 3 hours, maybe that's a reason he strategically didn't ask the court, district court, to order the release. He thought he had 3 hours. If it sounds like just that morning he found out he had one, maybe that's a very reason. That maybe that's a good reason that he had not to make the official request.
Perhaps. I don't know what his thought process was in all of that. I only know that if he thought he needed his client there, there's indications in the record that his client can't be there even to help him respond to what's happening in the courtroom. Because even if he'd had 3 hours by phone, that wouldn't have happened. And that he really needed his client there. Mr. Saucier indicates that in the record, yet he didn't take the steps to try to secure that. If you're really concerned about due process and your client being able to be present and participate, there's an easy way to at least attempt to do that. And no attempt was made with regard to that. I think when you look at this, there's no right to attend, there's no right to testify, there's no right to counsel. Mr. Bursa had all of that. He had counsel for the entire process for over a year. His counsel was his power of attorney. When he says he was in prison and couldn't get in the house to get documents to trace, et cetera, his counsel had his own power of attorney. He didn't even need releases. He can go to the banks and get that information. He can go to whomever he needs to get the documents. So he had counsel for that full year. He had counsel present at the trial, after the trial. He testified. He testified by numerous affidavits. And there is case law that indicates that even a deposition testimony is appropriate due process. And so this is beyond even deposition testimony. He testified for an hour, and he put in three affidavits, and there was no limit. He didn't ask to put in more affidavits. I would also point out that the trial occurred over 2 days, and there was a break in between. There was a day delay in between the 2 days. The alleged surprise testimony about the garage happened in the morning of the first day of trial. All witnesses testified on that subject in the morning before the lunch break. Mr. Bursa didn't testify until after the lunch break. There's no indication anywhere in the record that this garage issue was such a significant surprise that there was no response. There is Mr. Saucier indicating I could use more time, but he doesn't specifically reference the garage issue. He did ask only one question on that subject. If he was concerned about it and was surprised about it, he could have asked the court for some time to discuss the matter with his client. He could have discussed it over the lunch break. He had a full day between days of trial. He didn't come back on the second day and say, I haven't been able to get in touch with my client. We got surprised by this evidence on the first day. I need to be able to keep the record open to have my client provide testimony on this. All of that could have been done, but I don't think that issue was preserved for appeal.
Was there such a request at a later time?
No.
I thought there was.
Oh, there was.
There was a request at some point to keep the record open for further.
There was a request after the record had closed, or after the judgment and decree I apologize. No, before the judgment and decree, there was a motion to reopen the record at that point, which the court denied, if my recollection is serving me correctly. But it was based on primarily evidence that would not support a new trial or a motion for amended findings. It was based on evidence that was available during the trial but simply hadn't been presented. And so the court denied it on those grounds.
I think your point is that his counsel did not express concern about the surprise at the beginning of the second day. Is that...
His counsel didn't...
That's your point, I think, right?
That is one of the points,
but he did so later after the record had closed.
Correct. Okay. During the trial, that was never expressed.
Okay.
I think that concludes my time. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Corbett. Mr. Friedrichs, you have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. As I understand the accessibility to someone in incarceration, it's very difficult, and I don't know how Mr. Saucier over a lunch hour could have arranged with the prison system to pull Mr. Bursoff from a cell to discuss what had happened in the morning. That he was having difficulty dealing with Mr. Bursoff and getting information all along. However, he did produce significant amounts of documents. There are is a stack of exhibits from the respondent that's 40-some exhibits. It's inches thick. They were produced before the trial.
But when did counsel find out that his client was available for only 1 hour instead of 3 hours?
I'm not aware of when that occurred. I was not trying the case. I do know that he expressed to me that he was frustrated that the system had told him that Mr. Bursaw was not going to be allowed to come to Mankato to participate and that all he would be able to do was have him there by telephone. That's not in the record. It's a recollection I have. I don't know the time limits that were initially put by the system, but that's an issue out there. Transfer of property for the tracing, as the court recognizes, is different than the transfer or the tracing for the equity from the homes forward. The court did recognize that, and that there is a difference there that we believe is important. The trust of Gerald Bursaw doesn't say to both of them. It says to Mr. Bursaw, he chose as an estate planning action to set up the joint tenancy. So it was an inheritance for him of the land that 140 Mary Oak was on. I don't think there can be a question that the value, at least of that land, should have been a non-marital interest. The parties did build a house on it, and that those improvements included some of the equity that Mr. Saucier in his submissions to the court show were values that came from the very beginning house were equity transfers up based on the evidence that he was able to gather, based on his ability to get things as Mr. Bursaw directed him where to go.
So just so I understand, even if the land is considered a gift, so it's marital property, there's still a remaining issue about the value of the improvements?
Tracing of some of the equity from those house sales into the improvements for 140 Mary Oak. Yes.
What's your position about what that value? I mean, what is the value of the improvements as a whole, and then what is your position as to the non-marital property in the improvements?
I believe the exhibits and testimony showed that 140 Mary Oak was built for about $301,000, and then there was some money put in after they moved in to build a three-stall garage and to pave the driveway and such. That's all in the record. The exact amount that traces forward are in the documents that Mr. Saucier submitted as the findings of fact, proposed findings of fact and conclusions. I thought that number was in the $100,000 range, but I don't have that right readily available. I'm sorry. That's all I have. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Friedrichs. Thank you to both counsel. Case is submitted. The court will issue its opinion within 90 days as required by statute.